Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is the first episode in the Venice Film Festival series for 2023. Just wanted to make sure I timestamp it. And I am currently outdoors, right outdoors from the casino, which is where about half of the movies show, or a lot of the movies show, on a sunny day after a rainy opening, a rainy arrival for me at least. And I'm happy to be kicking things off with Mr. Glenn Kenny of the New York Times, Roger Ebert. Hello, Glenn.
Yeah, and I have a blog and stuff, which I sometimes contribute to.
Absolutely, and people should read your latest DVD and Blu-ray.
Blu-ray 4K consumer guide. I'm a big booster of physical media.
Yes.
And my readership on the blog definitely reflects that. Yeah, we're out here on the plaza, and it's a beautiful, God, it's a gorgeous day. It makes me nervous when I'm at a film festival, and it's a gorgeous day, and things are going well, because it reminds me of 9/11.
Oh, Jesus.
No, it does. Wow. Honestly, I remember 9/11. I was in Toronto with Premiere Magazine. A couple of days after we had our big party, where I introduced David Lynch to Monica Bellucci. I actually did that.
All right.
I introduced David Lynch to Monica Bellucci at the premiere party. I told Richard Harris that I'd run into Jimmy Webb at the food court at LaGuardia Airport, and Richard Harris responded, "Jimmy Webb! Jimmy Webb!" And I was walking around Toronto in the subsequent days thinking how beautiful things were, and had dinner with the lead actress from The Lady and the Duke, and the next morning I went to see Monsoon Wedding, and I came out and I saw my colleague, a colleague from Entertainment Weekly, on a phone crying, and I said, "Oh, poor Maggie, I wonder if her uncle died." But it was not that. It was 9/11. And,
oh, man.
You know, I actually had thought that morning, God, things are going so great. And then it was 9/11. So I get nervous when, like this morning, I was going into the screening of Ferrari, and I had, you know, things were just going so well, and it was so beautiful. I was like, I shouldn't even think that things are going so well. Something horrible is going to happen.
Jeez, what?
But if so, something horrible happens. I don't hope it doesn't. I remember also seeing Fat Girl. Fat Girl, the Catherine Brulotte film, was at that festival. And I remember walking out of that screening, it was before 9/11, thinking, that's a good movie, but the ending's a little arbitrary. And after 9/11, I didn't think that anymore.
Ah, yeah.
I wouldn't say it redeemed Fat Girl for me, but it gave Fat Girl added and even truer resonance, because the ending wasn't really arbitrary as anything that could happen in real life. But we're here, it's many years later, I'm so old, and we're here in Venice, and today we just saw
Ferrari.
Whoa.
Probably one of the most anticipated titles. Been how many years since the last Michael Mann film?
Black Cat was not that long ago, but it was somewhat long ago.
Feels like long ago somehow. And already it's had its revival.
Director's cut, coming out on the upcoming Blu-ray edition from our good friends at Arrow Films.
Which you've seen, right? You've watched it.
I have seen it. Yeah, they're going to include that on the in the package. They found a version of it. 2015 is Black Cat, so yeah, it's almost 10 years.
Yeah.
And this is a very different movie than Black Cat. When I was saying to you before we started, this is a man not in genre mode or action mode, but in his kind of middle brow, serious mode. But with action, obviously, because the story is about Enzo Ferrari, the race car driver and subsequent race car manufacturer, and a very significant period in his life. The movie takes place in 1957 in the run-up to the 1,000-mile race. There was a huge deal in Italian racing culture. It has one or two flashbacks to earlier in his life in the 1940s during World War II, but it mainly sticks to what seems to be about a single month in the life of Enzo Ferrari and his wife and the mother of his son, his living son, you know, living in secret from the wife, who is his business partner. It's a knotty little story, obviously, and it ends in a remarkable cataclysm.
Yeah.
But in that month's worth of story, it does manage to tell the story of this innovator in automobile engineering and racing and style, certainly stylish cars. Ferrari is a car that's synonymous with style as well as speed.
Yeah, I think at one point he says the back of one of the cars, he compares it to a sculpture.
Yeah, so. You know, nobody talks about this about the Mann film, but for a very long time, David Cronenberg, who's as much of a car freak as Michael Mann,
oh, yeah.
wanted to make a racing movie about Ferrari called Red Car.
Oh, wow.
And he actually couldn't get financing for it because of the other films he'd made. And I often wonder what a Cronenberg Ferrari movie would be like. I think his intention was to stick close to the facts and be non-fantastic. But it was a script he really loved. I don't, you know, and I don't know if it dealt with the same time period as this film did. This film is actually, the script is adapted from a book by Brock Yates, the sports and racing writer.
Mm-hmm.
Cronenberg's was based on his own research. I mean, we now have two Ferrari movies. We have Ford versus Ferrari,
which I didn't hate. It was, I kind of liked it as a story, basically about management.
Yeah.
That's what that movie was
right,
about.
Right, right. Just like Air.
this one is...
This is well before Ford versus Ferrari, yeah, I think.
Yeah, the tug of war between personal obligations, emotional obligations, and just the ceaseless drive.
Yeah, it's kind of a domestic drama with auto racing and manufacturing as a backdrop to a certain extent.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Logan Paul, remember that idiot guy who complained about Oppenheimer being only talking? if he goes see Ferrari, he'll be very upset. It's like, it's only him and his wife bitching at each other and then his girlfriend. What the fuck is the deal with that? I wanted to see more racing. And when the racing finally comes around, it's a total bummer because they, you know, et cetera.
Well, what did you make of each of the lead performances?
I thought they were great, actually. I thought Driver was fantastic. But in a way, the movie's kind of owned by Penelope Cruz. At first, the part of Laura seems relatively one-dimensional. She's the woman scorned who also happens to own half the company.
Mm-hmm.
But the part itself grows deeper and more interesting, and Cruz takes advantage of every opportunity she has to... She's a great actor. I mean, she's just
terrific.
A flat-out great actor.
Yeah.
And always has been. You know, when she first came around, people were just sort of almost benumbed by her beauty. And one great thing about the way she's used by Almodovar is he shows her for the actor she is. And this movie does as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Not to take away from Driver. Driver is amazing. Driver is particularly amazing when you look at White Noise, the film he made, you know, the notable film he made immediately prior to this one.
Yeah.
And you look at him in this, whereas in White Noise, he's this relatively ineffectual, befuddled character. And, you know, in this film, like it or not, he is the maestro. He's the master, and he owns the mastery. He's very confident. He's not cocky. He understands what he's doing to a huge extent, but he also has let his personal life get a little out of control.
Yeah.
Because he had this child out of wedlock with a woman that his wife has not been informed about. That woman, Lila, is played by Shailene Woodley, who I think, I wouldn't say is the weak link of the film, because nothing she does in the movie contributes to its detriment, but honestly, I was sort of like, ah, Shailene Woodley kind of like finally climbed out of her treehouse to make a film that's based on a completely ecologically unsound practice. Like, I wonder how she was compelled to do this, because she's not a big gasoline person.
That's true. I hadn't even thought about that aspect. I mean, she weakest link might be too strong, but I was a little underwhelmed by her as a just kind of compelling figure for him to upend his life. I mean, I guess part of it is that it was a connection of like circumstances that they got together during the war.
She's fine. You're not going to sit and look at it and say, I don't get it. And to her credit, she doesn't bring a lot of, you know, Shailene Woodley-ness to it. She acts,
yeah.
And it's good. But in the scenes with her and Driver is clearly the stronger force. And in the scenes with Driver and Cruz, they're completely evenly matched. Let's
yeah.
put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing that was kind of stark to me, I mean, each of them, Shailene Woodley and Penelope Cruz, they each have a kind of centerpiece monologue.
Yeah.
And it's kind of no contest. It's kind of an unfair comparison, but just no. It reminds you that, yeah, Cruz is incredible. She goes to like 10 different, you know, emotions in that one monologue. Yeah, she is the force kind of at the center of the film. But there are cars.
The racing stuff is good. There's not as much of it as a lot of people are going to expect.
I think so, yeah.
But what's there is initially choice, and then it's devastatingly horrific.
Yeah.
If you know anything about the history of this race and what happened in 1957,
yeah.
I won't talk about it because, you know, go in cold and get the full emotional effect.
I have to say that that was one of the strongest scenes in the movie for me, and I also don't want to give it away.
The thing about Mann is, and he shares this with Nolan, that there's a his particularity. There are scenes that he does that are composed in just such a way that you're like, he makes sure that you're going to see what he's showing you. And the scene at the end is very, he lays it out with great specificity and very interesting techniques of slowing things down, speeding things up,
yep.
dropping the sound out. He is like Scorsese, you know, that he wants to take you by the scruff of the neck and say, you're going to watch this, you're going to see this.
Yeah.
And he has a way of doing that that's very specific to his own style of filmmaking. A couple of weeks ago, we were watching at home Akira Kurosawa's High and Low. And what's really interesting in that is a lot of what he throws away from his own textbook as a filmmaker. And he makes the viewer work at the end to follow what's happening in the action. He does a lot of very long shots. He doesn't do cutaways or inserts to find out, you know, who's giving the drugs to who. He makes you watch more carefully.
Yeah.
Mann isn't like that. Mann is like, you're going to see this. I'm going to lay this out for you. And, you know, once you see it in Ferrari, you see it. You really see it.
Yeah. And that said, I mean, that's, I guess, part of why it also hits so hard is that a lot of the movie's fairly charming, I have to say. I thought the screenplay was pretty funny.
It's a very intelligent script in an intelligent script way. Certain scenes and certain lines of dialogue are very sort of like, I won't say on the nose, but it's like the contrivance is not entirely seamless, but it's so intelligently applied that you don't mind, you know. In that way, that's another way in which it's kind of a classical movie.
It's
not indifferently scripted at all.
That's true. Yeah, he sets up a number of oppositions and, you know, the style and just keeping the company running.
Yeah, there's this whole sort of subplot of him, you know, the company's facing ruin. They need to establish, they need to achieve certain goals in order to get where they need to be. But eventually, you know, it becomes clear that where they need to be is going to need a partnership. And he arranges a potential partnership through a certain manipulation that's very interesting.
Yeah, sort of elegantly done.
Yeah.
And he does allow himself a little moment of appreciating what he did, too. He's just like, okay.
Well, that's the thing about the character, as written and as played by Driver. He's very elegant. He's older. He has a bit of a pot belly. But he carries himself with a very knowing kind of elegance. As we say nowadays, it's the character's brand. And Driver's performance, you know, Driver's a great physical actor as well as a great line deliverer, and his physical bearing in the movie is spectacularly well realized.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And yeah, again, just another word on the racing. Like, I had a review recently of a video game adaptation of the Gran Turismo franchise, which basically just wasn't a lot of fun, you know. Yeah. I mean, I thought that movie, of all things, I only mentioned it to say that, you know, reminds me, oh, it does make a difference how you film, how you shoot racing, the mechanics of that and the editing rhythms, you know, the cycling through different angles on the car, even when you just cut away to make more suspense from the whole race, you know.
Yeah.
And that's here, even though, again, there's not as much racing as one might
expect.
Mann's
a car guy, like Cronenberg. Cronenberg's a car guy. He made Crash. Mann's a car guy. He makes Ferrari. And Mann, you know, you hear stories of Mann, you know, showing up in his Lamborghini at editing rooms at 4 a.m. and stuff. You know, I have a screenwriter friend who, you know, got the, you know, Michael Mann sports car experience.
Oh, yeah.
He's better at it than Elon Musk. I mean, Mann knows cars. You know, Elon Musk, the famous story of Elon Musk crashing out his, you know, one-of-a-kind sports car with Peter Thiel in it. And neither of them got injured, which is shows you how unfair life is. And show us what you can do. It says, oh yeah, I'll do that. Wow, you know. Whereas, but Mann knows cars. So there's a nice scene in there where he's explaining to the boy, the illegitimate kid, that he an intake manifold.
Oh yeah.
And how it works. And again, that's a very elegantly turned scene.
It really is.
It is about Mann's love of cars, and you know, despite the horror they can wreak. I think, man, the belief of this film is that you can only love cars if you can appreciate them in every aspect of what they're capable of doing.
Yeah.
My dad would have loved this movie. I didn't recommend movies to my dad that often. He wasn't a movie person, but I remember I recommended Ford versus Ferrari to him. Before I even finished saying the title, he said, oh, is that about Carroll Shelby? I'm like, yeah. So, you know, I think this is another movie he would have been like, yeah, cinema. No, he wouldn't have said that.
But that's not just what you're saying about that it's a movie that requires you to accept cars, everything about them. Because by the end, I almost felt like, wow, you know, they survived the war in a way only to create new circumstances of death, basically. Yeah. And also in the context of just like this brute competition, because they're, you know, that arguably is not my judgment because I like the beauty of it, but arguably is kind of superfluous to create faster and faster cars.
I mean, yeah, Cronenberg loves cars, but he made a film that's specifically about cars as death machines, erotic death machines. He gets it.
But erotic death machines, at least.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's some first thoughts on Ferrari.
Ferrari, see it.
See it.
You can't get to the theater fast enough. Drive your Ferrari to see Ferrari. I know. Why aren't I in marketing?
So now we'll do a U-turn, or not a U-turn, but we'll take a different path to talk about a movie that maybe people don't know as much about, and I kind of like switching it up like this, and that's Hollywood Gate, which is a documentary that also screened for the press on the first day of screenings on Wednesday, and I think is worth mentioning. It's a documentary in Afghanistan set in the immediate aftermath of the withdrawal, you know, of U.S. forces, and it's basically following around a Taliban commander. In the beginning, you learn that he's supposed to run the Air Force, and that almost seems like a joke.
Yeah.
But as the movie goes on, you learn what that ultimately will mean. And this is a movie just with incredible access and incredible gutsiness on the part of the filmmaker.
Oh, it's terrifying. This poor guy, he's a journalist, and his name is Ibrahim Nashat.
Yes.
And he goes in with this, you know, digital video camera and these Taliban dudes who don't raise their voices that often, if at all. It's very unnerving the way they are. And they've always been like this, my vast experience with the Taliban. The Taliban guys have always been like this. They don't raise their voices, but they say things like, yes, he is filming us. If his intentions are bad, may he die soon.
It was like a villain line. I couldn't believe it.
And they say stuff like that. They're very weird. The word Taliban means student. I used to have a friend who was Nick Kristof's personal assistant back in the
New York Times columnist.
Yeah, she no longer does that. But she remembers one time the Taliban came to visit the Times offices when they were allowed to be in the country. A couple of Taliban representatives came to visit the Times offices. She was like, they were so quiet. I'm like, don't be stupid. But she's right. And they all wore glasses, these little wire and spectacles. I'm like, they're the Taliban. Now they're older. The guys in this movie are kind of middle-aged, older, but they all do wear wire-rimmed glasses, and they're quiet.
Yeah.
And they say, if his intentions are bad, may they die soon.
Yeah.
But here's the thing about that movie that's fascinating, is the fact that the Taliban, now they're in charge of this country, and the movie makes unbelievably clear that not only are they fucking completely incompetent to govern, but they never had any interest in governing in the first place. There's the one guy who's driving around saying, I wish the Americans were still here. He's looking at the streets of Kabul. And, you know, I wish the Americans were still here. I would put my machine gun on a tripod. I would fire so many bullets until my lust for vengeance was satisfied. And then I would martyr myself. And it's like, dude, what are you doing here? You're not qualified. Clearly, it's the Peter principle of jihad. You know, you rise to your level of incompetence where you now have to actually run the country instead of killing the infidel dog colonialist imperialist invaders. And you can't do it. You can, however, fix a helicopter.
Yeah.
That's what they can do. They can find people to fix the helicopters.
Yeah, and that's where the movie, that's where you understand why this commander is the commander of the Air Force and is pretty damn lucky because, as it turns out, his mechanics can fix the vast array of, you know, military hardware and aircraft that have been left behind, partly disabled, but not enough.
And it's interesting, too, because despite how, you know, not likable, these Taliban guys, you can't relate. They're not likable. Despite how like maniacal, psychopathic, and not particularly likable these Taliban guys are, despite being soft-spoken and wearing wire-rimmed spectacles. The movie also, through them, reflects American arrogance.
Mm.
The whole way, you know, we just sort of left $2 billion worth of equipment there and say, well, fuck these guys, they're never going to figure it out. And then they figured it out. Not the greatest plan. And that's the thing. They're not, they're rehabilitating these helicopters not to protect their country as such, but because they're going to try and fuck with Tajikistan.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, because it's all they know how to do is make war.
Which is another example of the amazing, the film's amazing access. They actually have a phone call that we listen in on where the commander is threatening the head of defense of Tajikistan, and you're like, I couldn't even believe what I was hearing.
Then when the Russians come to visit, and the Russians
oh,
are so
God,
like,
oh, God, the diplomats from everywhere
great,
come.
Guys, yeah. Get us the fuck out of here. It's like an hour and 23, 26 minutes. It's not that long, but every minute of this thing is absolutely charged. I think everybody should see this movie if you have any interest in the world you live in. I mean, that's a very Stanley Kramer kind of line, but I mean, you're not going to find this kind of revelation about this area of the world in any other movie I've ever seen.
Well, it's fascinating to pair it with a movie by Matthew Heineman that I reviewed, which was about the withdrawal from the U.S. perspective. And that one has these extended scenes of what was, you know, covered a lot in the news of the planes leaving and people trying to get on. And it has that has a kind of parallel scene to this. That's very interesting.
I haven't seen that film, but I'd love to check it out.
Yeah. And one other thing I also want to underline, that they are these bespectacled Taliban, but they also casually are tossing off these horrible lines about the women in the country and what they should be doing.
Oh, the great analog. I said, well, you know, people ask me why, you know, women should be covered at all times. And I talked this Westerner out of his disbelief that, you know, women shouldn't wear the burqa by telling him the analogy of the chocolate that gets, you know, on the ground. It's like, so he really bought that? Because there's several category errors inherent in this in this argument. But
for me, that through line of the hatred of women is really important in the movie because you're ready to laugh at them for how incompetent they are. But then they say these chilling things and you know that people will die because of this and that people will be abused because of that.
It's less funny.
Although there is a fair amount. He does have an eye, this filmmaker, for all the little screw-ups.
Yeah. It's incredibly, every minute of it is just charged and compelling and, worthwhile.
So that is Hollywood Gate, a documentary that, as far as I know, I don't think has a distributor lined up.
Go see it.
So go see it. One more movie we'll cover, the new movie by Luc Besson.
Luc Besson. I got some things to say. What's that line from Badlands? You don't talk much. I got some things to say. Doge Man, because we're in Venice, I call it Doge Man. That's awesome.
What is Dog Man about?
Dog Man is about a fucking dog man. I mean, sorry. It's about a guy played by Caleb Landry Jones who dresses in drag and has some sort of psychic connection with dogs, which enables him to get them to do his bidding, which it's implied his bidding is actually kind of morally correct at all times. Mm-hmm. So it's more like the dog's just doing what's right as opposed to following his will, or else it would just be like essentially Willard with dogs, because the dogs do some pretty messed up things, but only to the right people. Yeah, I mean, this film is, it's weird because it's, if you follow Luc Besson's weird imagination through his various iterations, there's a way in which, despite not having worked too much with animal acts before, this is the most Luc Besson-y of Luc Besson movies. But it's weird, too, because it's kind of, in its own way, ineffectual.
Mm.
Like John Wick. Remember John Wick 4?
Oh, yeah.
You know the German Shepherd in that movie? There's this German Shepherd in John Wick 4 that's fantastic. That's a through line of the whole movie. And it's only one dog. I mean, John Wick is predicated on the whole idea of the whole thing started because they killed his first dog.
Right.
But in this movie, there's a new dog, and it's partnered with another assassin who seems to be ready to get a franchise of his own. And he has this awesome German Shepherd. So that's one dog in this movie. So Dog Man has like 10 times the number of dogs
so
in
many
it
dogs
than John Wick 4, and yet somehow it manages to have less dog appeal than John Wick 4. I don't know how Luke did it, because you're not sitting there going, look at the puppy. It's like, I don't know why. I mean, the dogs are great in this movie, but it doesn't seem to be like, you're not loving the dogs like the way you love the dog in John Wick 4.
But I thought that was a decision. I like the dogs.
They're likable, but they're not lovable.
What is this?
When you put dogs in a movie, I mean, except for Strays. I mean, when you put dogs in a movie, you want to be, look at a puppy.
But I thought that was a decision largely because he wants you to focus on Caleb Landry Jones.
On the Caleb Landry Jones, who lip syncs Piaf in the movie.
Not only Piaf.
Piaf and
Dietrich.
Dietrich, yeah. Is it so great that Dietrich really does pronounce her R's as W? I mean, it's not, people do that as a send up, but she really does. would be great at the gate of Marlene, you know, so whatever the words are. But yeah, it's a real showcase for Caleb Landry Jones, who here plays a relatively sympathetic character. Most of us remember him as the Kentucky Fried brother from Get Out, and as the drug addict in Twin Peaks: The Return, the bad drug addict boyfriend.
Assorted, squirrely, skeezy roles.
But here he plays a relatively sympathetic character while maintaining a certain edge. The whole movie takes place in Newark, New Jersey, which for some reason apparently has this transplanted white trash Alabaman family as the central characters that Caleb Landry Jones's character has to escape from. The movie has a really weird view of evangelical Christians, because it seems to believe that evangelical Christians are Catholic, which they are not.
Yeah, right.
Like when the brother does the prayer and he says, De Spiritus Sancti. He says, no, Joel Osteen wouldn't know Latin if you fucking hit him over the head with it.
Yeah, I'm glad you're pointing that out. That did bother me.
Did the Huguenots die for nothing, Luc Besson, given your understanding of American Christianity sects?
Yeah, there are a lot of like Euroisms
but it doesn't matter, because it's all him. It's his vision of Newark, despite being shot in Newark. Well, I think it's some of the locations are authentic. The movie is weird. It's kind of like, you know, whereas The Fifth Element I thought was genuine pop art, this is more like faux grindhouse kitsch in certain ways.
Yeah, slash Oscar bait in a way. I mean, it turns into that.
It won't get anywhere fucking near. No, it's not going to happen. I mean, Caleb Landry Jones, if the strike settles and he can campaign for the movie, he can do what he likes, and it is a good performance, but no fucking way. So we can talk about that, too, because Luc Besson is one of the problematic men of Venice. And there is an article in the Hollywood Reporter by some guy. What about the problematic men of Venice? It's all about Woody Allen, Roman Polanski, and Luc Besson. Luc Besson has been accused of sexual assault, sexual harassment. The accusations were never formally charged legally, and he's never gone to trial. But anyway, there was this article, and one of the sources was someone from a French activist group who said that, you know, by having these three men at Venice, you're celebrating perpetrators. There was also Joe Livingston, the quote-unquote culture critic. She said, well, you know, to censor these films would be wrong, but, you know, we should also question why these films are there in the first place. She said, you know, I saw the trailers for the films, and they didn't look that interesting. So now, according to cultural critic Joe Livingston, we can now judge films based on their trailers. So that's a good advance for us. And the writer of the article mentioned Alberto Barbera talking about Caravaggio. Caravaggio was a murderer, and he was a convicted murderer. So do we not look at Caravaggio's? And the very, very clever argument advanced by the Hollywood Reporter guy was like, well, Caravaggio isn't doing a press conference in Venice, and Caravaggio doesn't have living accusers accusing him of sexual assault. And I'm like, so according to this guy's moral code, I guess there really is a statute of limitations for being upset about people having committed murder. You know, okay, we don't need to care about Caravaggio because nobody is alive from Caravaggio's time, whereas people are alive in this time. I'm like, it's still murder. Right. Is that the actual logical hill you want to stand on for this issue? I mean, I don't want to be glib about it, but by the same token, these arguments in the cells are pretty glib. Well, I saw the trailer. It didn't look interesting. Seriously?
Somehow I don't think that it will affect this particular movie for Dogman.
Well, yeah, no, people in the United States aren't really aware of who Besson is, even though they know a lot of his movies. You know, and again, well, it all depends on the extent to which they'll actually be able to promote it. If this actor's strike ends and the film comes out in the Oscar season and Jones can promote it, yeah, he might get some attention. It's a bravura performance, to be sure. And he carries the movie. Everybody in the movie is rather good. Jones is the only name, except for Marissa Berenson, who is in a highly Botox cameo.
She's the woman.
You didn't recognize her because she doesn't look like Marissa Berenson anymore, because that's what people do.
That's right. There was a credit with the participation of
Marissa. Right. You only recognize her when she takes off her eyeglasses and you see those blue eyes. Her eyes are the only thing about her that still looks like her. And she's fine. You know, she does some acting. But Jones is he's all over the place. But the thing that will fuck him up is two things. First of all, he's playing a paralyzed person, so people will say that his performance as a person who can walk playing a paralyzed person is ableist. And there's also the drag business. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here. But this is where the discourse is, and this is where I want to be as far away from as possible. I do think that the idea of we need to separate the art from the artist is a little reductive and simplistic, but there needs to be a ratio. I don't know, Besson. I met him. I actually got to go out to California.
For which movie?
For Fifth Element. These were the days when the magazines had money. They'd send you to California, and I'd stay at the Chateau Marmont, and I went out. Magazines had money. Movie studios had money. So what was Sony was the studio behind Fifth Element, and I don't know where he shot it. I think he shot a lot of it in Europe, but he was editing it. He had to do post in the States. But he didn't do it on the studio grounds. They rented in this huge house in Malibu on the Pacific Coast Highway. They shipped to him boxes of his favorite bande dessinées. he had a rear projection TV that he looked at assemblies on in the den. Mm-hmm. And he is just on the beach overlooking the ocean every single day, living his best life, editing the film on Sony's dime at a beautiful rented house with every creature comfort and all his favorite comic books. I'm like, this is the fucking life, Luc Besson. He took me downstairs and he showed me, I think, the first 20 minutes of the film. And it was one of those things where, unless you'd seen Heavy Metal, from which he, you know, basically stole a huge portion of the plot. But in terms of the execution and everything else, you had not seen anything like it before. It really was a groundbreaking film.
I remember getting so much joy out of just the excess in that.
Yeah, he went nuts. And he was spending a lot of money, but you saw a lot of it on the screen. He's not a tortured artist, at least not then. He really enjoyed doing this. The Orson Welles remark about the biggest electric train set. I mean, he was reveling in his freedom and just bringing these really unusual visions to life. He was into it. And Sony was kind of scared. They had committed a huge amount of resources to the film, and they had this amazing, they had Bruce Willis at the height of his stardom, and that really helped them out a lot. But they were very, I think to a large extent, they were very worried about the movie. And I think it took off. And they were still worried about it even after it did well, because they were confused as to why it did so well, because it's so outre. And I don't think he ever did anything quite on that scale or as successfully again. I mean, and then when he got into Joan of Arcville, it was all over to a certain extent.
Lucy has kind of become a cult
Lucy,
favorite.
Yeah, but Lucy is made on such a... I mean, Lucy's made on a relatively big scale, but you can see, look at Lucy against Fifth Element, and it's a very different thing. Yeah. Even Valerian, which is moderately enjoyable, I thought.
I haven't.
I'm the Luc Besson enjoyer has logged on. I mean, I don't go back to it. I'll go back to Lucy. Valerian, while watching it, I was like, yeah, this is trippy, and you know, the kids have some attitude, but he's not. It doesn't have the same vitality as Fifth Element. I mean, that Fifth Element was his height, really. Yeah. I think.
Well, people will discover Dogman.
Yeah, I mean, this has a bit of Leon in it. In the climax, yeah. But much more low-key, much more low-key.
Well, it's funny, in the climax, throughout the movie, I was kind of impressed, like, wow, he's really going for it in this character study told in flashbacks from a interview with a psychiatrist. And then the end, you can see him just let loose and have a lot of fun with an action, beat-down sequence that is also really
But also
good.
Being restrained, because you can show people getting riddled with bullets, but you don't show dogs actually mauling people.
Exactly.
Because you want to keep them likable. There's this whole subplot in there about the psychiatrist who is a single mother, and the father of her child is in rehab and he has a court order against him. And I was really, I felt like this might have been one of those movies that got cut down from a 2-hour, 45-minute cut. I think there might have been some sort of subplot there where the dogs have to protect the psychiatrist and the kid from the father. But I think this is a little under 2 hours, and it moves like a motherfucker. As much as I say kitsch, I say grindhouse, I give all these caveats, but one thing the movie has absolutely on its side is that it's just boom, 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 boom. You know, if you can go with it, it can sweep you right up. That's a lot you have to go with, though. But it's really efficient. Because when they do this sort of flashback to what happened to get him in the room with the psychiatrist, I remember looking at my watch and it's like, the movie's almost over. Yeah,
it's incredible. And also with what happens in his childhood, I'm like, wow, is this movie crashing and burning right now? And then somehow it just keeps soaring.
Because it's ridiculous. The whole childhood thing is absolutely...
It's entirely ridiculous. And what you said about him having a psychic connection to the dogs is part of what makes the character like sort of meaningless in a way. It's this totally self-contained character that just wills his way.
No.
Well, at the end, I reserved like a 5% possibility at the end that it would just all be his imagination.
I mean, it literally is one of those movies that works best if you turn off your brain because, you know, because you're thinking, because listen to my complaints, evangelicals speaking Latin, Newark, you know, it's like, yeah, these are things you perceive if you're actually looking to be perceptive, but if you just sort of like, don't know from Newark from a hole in the ground or don't want to, then it's like, hey, yeah, whatever. Which Besson clearly doesn't. Yeah.
Last thing I'll mention is the couple of song choices that were sort of interesting. There's
Well, because he's so old.
Yeah.
He's so fucking old. Somebody was saying, what's ZZ Top song? Is it LaGrange? Or it's the ZZ Top song that goes down, 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 down. And the lyrics have nothing to do with what's going on in the scene. Like, it's like Billy Gibbons grumbling blues stuff. And then, you know, it kicks up. You know, it's soft, 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 tense, 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 and then loud, 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 loud. And it's like a total needle drop song. That it's just pure oral sight and sound shit. And then Sweet Dreams Are Made of This. Again, it's like, yeah, we're old. But then it does contextualize itself in the cabaret.
And and there's a sequence that's scored to like Miles Davis.
So what?
But it actually is a really good little sequence.
Yeah, I mean, he knows what he's doing. Yeah. He's just old, like I am. I'm like, it's fine.
Yeah.
But he doesn't care. That's the thing. He doesn't care. He's not trying to appeal to the kids. If he wants to have a fucking Caleb Landry Jones dressed up as Edith Piaf, he's going to do it. He does not care. Yeah. It makes him interesting.
So that's Dogman.
I mean, there's some Hesitation Wounds is a film from Turkey that's coming up in the festival that's an interesting film. It's kind of, I saw it. I thought it was really well done, but also leans to the anecdotal side. Like, is this a film or a novella? You know, sort of deal. It's very New Yorker novella if there was an equivalent to the New Yorker in Turkey.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad thing.
It's a very tightly focused character study of an attorney who's defending a guy whose story she thinks she understands, involving a killing at a factory where he works. And it just follows her on a kind of moral journey, I guess you'd say. Yeah, it's very, very focused. It's quite stylish camera work. So, yeah, I liked it. And that's Orizzonti, the horizon section, I think.
And there's films coming up that are going to be interesting.
What's the one or two you're most looking forward to?
I am looking forward to the Polanski, actually. But the Polanski is co-written with Skolimowski, which he's a genius.
Yes.
The thing about Polanski, though, this looks like a comedy. And he doesn't always do that well with comedies.
Right.
You may remember Pirates. You may remember What? Then again, you may remember The Fearless Vampire Killers, which is very good.
That's a lot of fun.
So it's an open. I'm looking forward to Priscilla.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to The Killer, our good friend David Fincher. Mm-hmm. I say our good friend. I've never met him, but I feel a connection to him somehow.
You have one degree of separation.
I have one degree of separation. I know his best friend. I'm pretty fully booked. I'm seeing five films tomorrow and five films the day after. Mm-hmm. On Monday, I have the panel. I'm here with the Biennale College.
Yes.
And the films there are very distinctive and noteworthy.
Are these the films you've already seen?
I've seen those already. I was able to see them before I came out here.
Okay.
And that makes my load lighter. But I'm interested in talking about them. And I met one of the filmmakers on the boat out, so that was interesting.
Cool.
I'm looking forward to seeing the restoration of Andrei Rublev.
Yes.
That'll take up all of Tuesday.
That's right.
And then I go home. But I've got a bunch of things coming up that I'm going to see at the Harmony Korine. The new Harmony Korine Desecration, shot on infrared. Yeah, can't wait. I just had a fucking eye injury. I had a vitreous hemorrhage after getting a torn retina, so now I'm going to go see a Harmony Korine movie shot on infrared. Did you see the 11:30 or the 8:30? The 11 o'clock or the 8:30 screening in Ferrari?
8:30.
Okay. Did they have a pink blob on the screen a lot of the time?
I didn't see that.
Yeah, there was something. There was a slight fault in the projection. No, it was bouncing around the screen.
Okay.
A sort of predominantly pink but rainbow-colored flaw that would bounce around on the screen. And I'm just, you know, I had no vision in my left eye for a while until I got surgery. And the blood drain, vitreous hemorrhage is a very exciting thing. But I was freaking out because I thought, oh, fuck, is my eye going out again? But then I'm like, and then I closed the eye that was affected, and it was in my right eye, too. And then I'm thinking, well, I'm having some sort of neurological episode. Right. And then I'm like, no, because it's only on the screen. It's not when I look at the ceiling or I look at my notebook. So it's definitely a flaw in the projection.
Interesting.
But it took me 20 minutes to figure that out. Kid sitting next to me saw it, too, so I also felt reassured. And now as I'm looking at this beautiful day,
yes,
I'm seeing no anomalies, so I'm good.
That's good. Okay, that's a relief.
Although I'm it's interesting. You know what happens when you have this surgery?
What's that?
Is that actually creates a cataract that you then have to have removed. I can tell the cataract is already forming because my eyesight in my left eye is still good, but it's a little blurrier than it was 4 weeks ago, which means I'll have to have cataract surgery next. My advice to you is if anything ever hits you on the surface of your eye and it blurs your vision a bit and you think, oh, it's just a surface thing, it'll take care of itself, do not say that. Go directly to your ophthalmologist.
That's really important advice. I hope everyone hears it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that won't happen here because everything's great.
Everything's beautiful. Nothing's going to happen.
Nothing's gonna grow.
I had so much fun doing this, as I always do with you.
Thank you for taking the time, and have a wonderful rest of the festival.
You got it.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.